Welcome to Radio Evolve. Welcome, Roman Krznarek. Very happy to have you here.
Well, I'm very much looking forward to the adventure of our conversation.
Thank you very much. So you are a philosopher, political scientist. You wrote numerous books, The Good Ancestor, Empathy, and recently the latest book, History for Tomorrow, and which also got translated into German, like also the book Good Ancestor. And you are a research fellow at the Long Now Foundation. You are a research fellow at the Ex Oxford University Center for Eudaimonia and Human Flourishing. And you are really promoting a big view on our human life, our human culture, and especially also in the last books on time and the development of history. And I want to start with that because I find that quite interesting how you approach time in a particular way as something that we need to learn, as I hear you or as I read you, learn a new relationship with, or in you also talk about a certain intelligence that we need to learn. Can you say a bit how that insight or that need came about for you to see we need really need a different approach to time and how we are situated in time?
Just to step back a bit, the last three books I've written have all been explorations of our relationship with time. So the book you mentioned, The Good Ancestor, is about our relationship with the future. And the book I wrote before that, called Carpe Diem Regained, is about our relationship with the present moment. And this new book, you just mentioned, History for Tomorrow, which has also come out in German, is about our relationship with the past. So I've been trying to cover as much of time as I can. But I've been particularly interested in reflecting on the past, I think partly because of the myopia, the obvious myopia of our current politics and culture and economies, the way that our politicians can't see beyond the next election or the latest, social media post, the way that markets spike and crash in speculative bubbles, and businesses can't see beyond the quarterly report. We're looking at our phones, clicking the buy now button. And in when we think about the future, there's often the politicians are crossing their fingers and hoping that technology will solve our problems for us. Their hope is in a sense, technological innovation. But actually, I think so much can be learned from history. And not the history of technological innovation, but really the history of social innovation, how human beings have managed to organize together throughout history to overcome crises and rise to challenges. It seems to me that history is one of the great untapped resources for thinking about who we are and how we can overcome the turbulence of our era, whether it's the ecological crisis or growing inequalities, how we can confront the risks of artificial intelligence, all these different things. Time, to me, seems to be an underlying problem. The tyranny of the now, especially, and our incapacity to think long term, but into the past as well as the future. And I think just one other thing to just add here is that, of course, politicians are often talking about the past, manipulating the past. They love the nostalgia, particularly dictators love the di nostalgia of the past. And I think generally, though, when we're thinking about learning the lessons of history, the focus is normally on learning from the warnings of history, everything that's gone wrong, captured in that famous aphorism that those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it. Now, of course, we need to remember the horrors of colonialism or the devastating impacts of fascism in the 1930s and 40s in Europe and elsewhere. But what I've tried to do in this new book, History for Tomorrow, is to look for the moments of hope and possibility, in a way to look for the more positive stories And that's not to say I'm not aware of the negative ones, but I think there's a sort of a missing piece of the puzzle for when we're trying to think about the possible project trajectories for our civilization today. How are we going to evolve as a large-scale civilization? How can we do that in a way without looking in the rear view mirror? You would never drive a car without looking in the rear view mirror. Well, this is how we have to travel into the decades and centuries ahead. I mean, what's your view about this? I mean, are you someone who thinks a lot about taking a historical perspective on things, Mike, or how do you view this?
Well, I think there is something powerful just in widening the scope of our awareness. Seeing that we are actually part of a that that part that we are part of a stream. That human history is not kind of single events, but that there is a stream of development. And I think that makes a lot of sense to see ourselves as part of that arc of development, which includes learning from what happened to see into the future. I mean, it's a bit the same as in our own biography, you could say. You also reflect on what happened in certain moments of your life to see, oh, wait a moment, maybe you learn something for the future. You don't want to make this mistake again, or you say, oh, that really worked, or something beautiful happened. So that is a good direction to follow on. And I understand what you're pointing to, a real widening of our awareness to see, oh, let's really look at also what happened in human history that can really also inspire us for the future. And we don't need to look kind of there's a real resource that is kind of untapped to maybe get ideas or glimpses of solutions. That's how I understand what you're pointing to, and that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and I think actually talking about it in a sense of an expansion of awareness is a very nice way of putting it, because I think often when we're thinking about expanding awareness, we think about expanding it through space, as across space, like you're meditating, you're sitting on the cushion, let's say, and you're trying to, in a way, feel the suffering of the world, and that is a potential motivation to get you off the meditation cu cushion and into the into action, in a sense. But I think we also need to think about expanding our awareness through time, as you say, and also not on just on the individual level, but collectively. Who have we been? When have we managed to confront problems and challenges? Is there anything to learn from the past for dealing with the crisis that we have today? And of course, I think there is. I've spent the last 4 years trying to find examples of this.
Can you maybe highlight maybe one example that you felt? I mean, you did a really deep research into that. Is there one example? Probably there are a few that really was something like an eye-opener for you to say, oh, wait a moment, there is really something to really look deeply into to understand where we are and where we might
Yeah, I mean,
go.
there are so many examples which, I've spent the last 30 years trying to think about how do we create a civilization that bends rather than breaks in the face of the challenges that are coming our way or that are already here. And I was amazed when researching this book how many things I'd never really heard of or I didn't know about. I mean, just to give you one small example, one of the topics of the book is about tolerance. I mean, how do we create societies that can deal with deep social divides? We know, of course, across Europe and many other countries, there are huge divisions around issues on immigration, let's say. And you can go through history and recognize that although there have been moments of great clashes between different peoples, there also have been moments of cooperation and empathy and tolerance. So, one example that I explored in detail in the book actually is in Spain, in between about the 9th and 13th centuries, the period known as the convivencia, or the living together or coexistence, when the south of today's Spain was ruled by an Islamic kingdom, Al-Andalus, or a series of kingdoms, where the historical evidence shows that actually, Muslims, Jews, and Christians managed to get on and create a reasonable culture of tolerance that lasted several hundred years. This is not utopia, of course. You know, there were everyday tensions and occasional outbreaks of violence, but by and large, cities like Cordoba in the south of Spain in the 11th century had about 500,000 people living in it, and it was basically a place of reasonable tolerance where if you were a Jew, for example, you wouldn't want to live in many other parts of Europe, but they went to the south of Spain. And in the marketplaces of Cordoba, you know, Muslims and Jews might play a game of chess, or Christians and Muslims might play music together, or people mix together in the marketplaces. And I think it's a really wonderful example, and there are many others, but this particularly good one, of how historically we have managed to get on together. And I think we're in an era today of almost a culture where we think there's an inevitable clash of civilizations, that we can't all live together in the cities of Europe or other places. We need to put up barriers and frontiers. And actually, we can look at history and think, well, how is it that other cultures and other epochs managed to do this? I find that very inspiring. And also on this same subject, just jumping to a slightly different example, was when I started researching the coffee houses that emerged in many European cities in the late 18th century, sorry, late 17th century, early 18th century, in Paris, you know, in Heidelberg, in London, where in London in the year 1700 there were over 2,000 coffee houses, and this is an institution which had come from Turkey, and in a way, it's in the same way that we tend to think of history being shifted or changed by these technological revolutions, like the steam engine, for example, or the iPhone. Well, the coffee house was a social technology which was designed or functioned to mix people together of different backgrounds. So if you went to one of the coffee houses in London in 1700, you could go to a coffee house and be talking about art or music or science or business, but particularly about politics. This is where new political ideas were discussed, like republicanism or anti-slavery, and often by people of very different social backgrounds. It wasn't totally democratic, of course. You know, they were mostly men rather than women, and not the poorest people of society. But they were kind of like miniature universities in a way, where you could sit on a cup of coffee all day, or in fact a bowl of coffee, because at that time they didn't have handles, and you would, in a way, be a citizen. And that's why, of course, the great German political theorist Jürgen Habermas, he wrote his doctoral thesis about the coffee houses of London, because he saw that this was the beginning of democracy in a way. And I think it's a message for today about the importance of the power of conversation to overcome divides. How do we create conversations between the people on the right and the left, or people who have lived seven generations in one small town, and migrants who've come in? And I think, again, history, let me say one more thing here, and this is a sort of more general point, is I'm not saying that history is a perfect blueprint with perfect models for the past that we can take from one period of history and we can just fit onto the present. But it's really about opening our imaginations to help us recognize that there are other ways of doing things, of organizing our societies or our economies or our politics.
And you also, as I hear you, and also in the book, you said social innovation, there are this kind of movements or possibilities of social innovation, which is also a different way of looking into history and not like the kind of the big events or the kind of things that are more happen on the level of the, you know, the politicians and the politics, but more where people also somehow innovated a different way of being together in the kind of a, you know, more could say coming from a more from the intuition or a kind of sense of what is a good way to live of the people and not so much of institutions or politicians.
I think that's absolutely right. I think there have been enough books written about famous politicians and generals and oligarchs and popes from the past. And since the end of the Second World War, really, there's been a revival or a flowering of the idea of history from below, that we should be telling the stories of everyday citizens. But it's still taking a long time to filter into our culture. And when it comes to learning the lessons of history, we tend to think about, oh, we must learn from, Winston Churchill or Napoleon or Nelson Mandela, even positive figures. But what about the more everyday way people organize themselves? So, just to give you another example, one of the historical gems, beautiful things I discovered when researching this book was about Switzerland. Between the year 15 and 23 in 1799, there was a small republic in today's Switzerland called the Free State of Rhaetia, or the Republic of the Three Leagues. I had never heard of that it before, and I used to be a university lecturer in democracy and political science. I'd never heard of this great example of grassroots democracy, where in the Free State of Rhaetia, the Republic of the Three Leagues, the way most decision making was organized was in neighborhood or town councils. There were about 250 neighborhood councils. People would meet in a local square or in a local pub in the wintertime to make decisions about their local area, the local taxes, or whose turn it was to clear the alpine and mountain pathways. And then for bigger decisions, they would send not an elected representative, but more an ambassador or a messenger up to a commune level. There were 50 communes, and then they had a kind of Bundestag, a kind of federal assembly that would meet a couple of times a year for foreign policy. So it was like the opposite of our democracies today. It was very much bottom up rather than top down. And I think it's the kind of political decision making we need to be thinking about today, a kind of decision making which is about including people, rather than just putting your letter X on a ballot sheet for an election every 3 or 4 years, but to actually be much more involved. And it's about, in some ways, it's like how the ancient Greeks thought about democracy, the idea of what today we call sortition, the random selection of citizens for public office, which we do for a jury, in a legal system. But now, in fact, of course, as we know across Europe in the last couple of decades, there's been the rise of citizens' assemblies where local people are randomly chosen to discuss and big issues for their town or their region or their country. It could be on climate or artificial intelligence. And one of the reasons I think these kinds of grassroots form of democracy is so important are going back to the earlier point about building tolerance. It's about bringing people together. And so one of my great discoveries in writing this book was of a 14th century Islamic historian called Ibn Khaldun, who wrote a book called The Muqaddimah, which was a great treatise of the rise and fall of civilizations. And in that book, there's a word that occurs over 500 times. And the word is an Arabic word, asabiyya, asabiyya. And what it means is collective solidarity or group feeling. And he believed that if we could expand asabiyya, that's what makes civilizations thrive. And when it gets asabiyya is broken by, for example, wealth inequality in a society, then civilizations fail. So I'm very interested in these examples, which are about bringing people together and building asabiyya, building tolerance. And I would say that Ibn Khaldun, this 14th century historian, he was interested in creating this solidarity between human beings. And I think that's not the only thing we need today. We also need a solidarity with the living world, with the trees, with the whales, with the soil, a kind of a deeper sense of interbeing, which I think someone like Ibn Khaldun, although very innovative, he wasn't seeing that importance, that ultimate, the great separation between self and world, which I think underlies, so much of the problems in today's world. And that's why I think historically we also need to look at, indigenous cultures and other societies where the bond with the more than human, with other organisms, was sort of is stronger than it is at least today in Western culture.
And what strikes me, what you were saying, is also I'm realizing how much our view on history is also constructed in a certain way. Like also, every culture writes its own history also to somehow, I mean, also the people or the worldview in power kind of writes history in a way to present a certain image of oneself as the necessary thing that needed to happen or whatever. And what you are saying is also that we can really look in history also for certain other values of certain other behaviors or processes of interaction or social innovation that actually respond to crisis that we are in today, that has to do also with things you mentioned, the kind of lack of connectedness with each other, polarization or the ecological destruction. So it also is a way to, the way we look in history, to really find or look for this ways of being that actually are a response or a kind of hint to a response to the predicaments that we are in now. And that means also a different way to look, what to look for in our history.
Yes, I think I really agree with you about that. And it really makes me think about the power of certain historical narratives, which are so dominant today. So, the classic one would be the idea of progress, that our civilization, in the West, to say in the global North, the wealthy countries of Europe, and so on, have, that our only our destiny is more growth, more material progress, more consumption, that this is what we should be aiming towards, and that this is the story of coming out of the poverty of the feudal era and things like that. But actually, no, that's one story, right? But there are other historical stories which are about not so much about growth, but are about balance. So I think like a good example would be Japan in the 18th century. During what's known as the Tokugawa period. So, at that time, like say in the mid 18th century or early 18th century in Japan, this was a period where there was very little trade between Japan and the outside world. So, they had shortages of precious resources like wood and cotton. And they were as dependent on wood as we are today on fossil fuels, and they needed cotton for everything. And one of the things that developed at that time because of the scarcity of resources was what we would today call a circular economy. So, for example, if you had a kimono that you might wear, you would wear it until the cotton cloth began to wear out, and then you would turn it into pajamas you'd wear at night, and then you would cut up the cloth and use it as nappies for your baby, and then you would turn that into cleaning cloths, and you'd finally burn the precious cotton as fuel. So, nothing was wasted. This was a society where everything was repurposed, refurbished, recycled. There were thousands of circular businesses in what's today Tokyo, what was known as Edo in the 18th century. It was a city then of over a million people, so far bigger than London or Paris or Frankfurt or anywhere at the time. And there were people who would come who would collect candle wax drippings to be remolded, or people would be repairing old umbrellas, or people would even come to your house and pay you for your human waste, which they would then sell as agricultural fertilizer. So, in a sense, 18th century Japan developed into one of the world's first large-scale, low-carbon, low-waste ecological civilizations. It's prime for not philosophy was really about balance, about having enough. There's a Japanese Buddhist term which is motenai. I've probably pronounced it very badly, but motenai, and it comes out of the Japanese Buddhist tradition, and it means enough, and well, that is the opposite of where we are today. If I go down my local shopping center, where everybody is probably at this very moment, the word enough is nowhere in people's minds, right? It's about excess, and it's not people's fault. I mean, people are allured into this by the advertising industry and multinational corporations and neoliberalism and all sorts of things. But I just think it's eye-opening to go to these moments of history and see even a large-scale society like Edo, Japan, with over 1 million people in it. They managed to have a society which wasn't all about growth, growth, growth. It was about balance, external, but also a kind of ultimately a kind of an inner balance as well.
Yeah, it's great. Also, I experience it myself, also hearing you bring this examples, how it really widens the imagination, also the inner space of possibilities, because there's also, you thought about the tyranny of the now, but there's also a kind of a tyranny of the status quo, or a certain way of doing society, of doing economy, of doing politics, that where you kind of are, you are so kind of can be so limited to, what, how it has been and how it is, that a real space to acknowledge, oh, it could be really different. It can be really different, and it can work differently. And I experience also, when you bring those examples, how they widen, how they loosen that frame of
Yeah,
how things
that's a
are.
nice way to put it. It's a sort of loosening the frame. And one of the frustrations of writing this book is there are so many other examples I wanted to bring in. So when I wrote about the circular economy in this book, I talked about Edo, Japan, but there are other examples which I didn't talk about. I could have talked about. So for example, in pre-colonial Hawaii before 1810, basically, where in the Hawaiian Islands there were over 1 million people living, they had also a kind of a circular economy, a no-waste circular economy. Today, they indigenous Hawaiian scholars call it the ancestral circular economy. And actually, this just makes me think of something else. Last week, I was interviewing a indigenous Mexican timekeeper from the Otomi Toltec people. And I asked him, I said to him, I said, "Oh, what do you think about AI?" And he said, "Well, I love AI, but not artificial intelligence, but ancestral intelligence," which I thought was a wonderful time. It was about respecting and learning from our ancestors, from the past, in a way. And so I've now become a fan of AI for the first time, but it's the ancestral intelligence rather than artificial intelligence.
Yeah, and this also connects to your former book about becoming a good ancestor, which is also part of that widening of the time awareness to learn, as I understand it, also that we really, we stand on the shoulders of ancestors, of generations. There are also generations to come that stand on our shoulders, or that will inherit what we bring, and also understanding those possibilities of history really opens, as I said, opens this kind of frame of possibility for the future, or what we can also maybe, give on to the future generation as possibilities to explore and to create culture in a different way. You also speak in relation to the future, also what something you call radical hope, a kind of different way of hoping. Can you say a bit more how you draw hope from that inquiry into this positive examples in the past?
Yeah, I think it's certainly easy enough to look at the past and come out feeling very unhopeful. Civilizations rise, but they all fall. And I'm not very hopeful in a sense about the prospects for our own civilization, in the sense that you just have to look at what's been happening at the COP30 climate negotiations in Belém in Brazil. There's many positive things, but also things are really not going nearly in the direction that they should be going. I like to draw a distinction between optimism and hope, a distinction which works in some languages and not others, but at least in English, optimism one tends to think of as a kind of a glass half full attitude, that everything will be okay in spite of the evidence. No, I'm not optimistic about the future of humanity because we're still locked in our fossil fuel society. We're still creating very dangerous technologies, AI and genetic engineering. We're still separated from each other and from the living world. But so that's optimism, glass half full. But by hope, I'm hopeful. What do I mean by hope? Actually, by hope, I mean being committed to the values and the vision that you have, even when the odds are against you, even when the chances of success may not be great. You know, I look at the world and think, well, how are we gonna beat, Shell and ExxonMobil and the oil companies and all of these, Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg? Well, they're the ones with the power. But I look through history and see incredible examples of change. Some of the ones we've spoken about, but also movements which have emerged to challenge those in power. Think of the great revolts against slavery on slave plantations in the Caribbean, in Jamaica, for example, in 1831, which accelerated the end of enslavement, or the movement against Indian independence. You know, those who fought against the British Empire in the 20th century, or first half of the 20th century in India, must have thought this is an impossible task. We are never going to overthrow this huge authoritarian colonial power. And yet they just kept going. And in the end, they did. And that was a kind of a victory for hope. But I think we also need another word in front of hope, which is a kind of radical hope. Radical, the word radical comes from the Latin for the roots of a tree. And I think that's about being rooted in your values. And we need a kind of a hope with the sleeves rolled up, our sleeves rolled up, as my wife sometimes says. You know, it's a kind of a hope full of action, hopium, which is hope without action. We need hope with action. But I think action takes many forms. You know, I think, yes, we need people being disruptive and on the streets and social movements, but we also need the people sitting on the meditation cushions and being powerhouses for peace. You know, we need people who are creating art. We need, people who are making music that brings people together, trying to create that asabiya, that solidarity, collective feeling that we need. Because when it comes to it, when a society's in trouble, you need to come together. This was the lesson of the San Francisco earthquake of 1906, for example, which has been written about brilliantly by Rebecca Solnit in her book, which one is it? A Paradise Built in Hell, I think, where she talks about how after the San Francisco earthquake in 1906, the government tried to come to people's aid. They were very pretty hopeless, but the local people set up soup kitchens, temporary housing, all sorts of things, which enabled people literally to survive in the aftermath of the earthquake. And we need a bit of that. We need to be ready for that.
And what you're saying also makes me think about the, you could say, the relationship between time and this time, trajectory and the timeless in a certain way. Because it seems also some of the values you are talking about, like also the solidarity or tolerance or even being in harmony with nature or with the living world, these are also in a certain way point to timeless truths in a certain way, to a realm where people in different ages and different cultures have seen, oh, this is actually the truth, like the true, the good, the beautiful. This is actually something that that is appropriate for human life on this earth. And also, as you were also speaking about radical hope, to keep to these values as a kind of root, keeps also somehow, I can see a deep can lead to a deep trust and resilience also in the face of, of this up and downs of of history and backlashes and all kinds of things that happen.
Yeah, that's fascinating, actually. I mean, I think in a sense this touches on topics of the philosophy of time, you know, and in a way the history of time and timekeeping. Because of course in Western cultures we are the inheritors of a linear conception of mechanical clock time, which emerged with the first mechanical clocks in Europe and particularly Italy in the 14th century, where we started slicing time up into little pieces. First into sections of an hour, but by 1700 most clocks had minute hands. By 1800 they had second hands. The clock became the key machine of the Industrial Revolution, speeding up the assembly line, getting people to clock in and clock out, and fining workers who were, you know, turning up late and this kind of thing. So there's a conception of linear time, the arrow of time, which goes from the past through the present into the future, which is very much tied to, I think, the ideology of progress and growth and those things we were talking about earlier. And I think one way to contrast it with is with a sort of, as you talked about, a kind of more kind of infinite, eternal sort of sense of time, a timelessness that transcends these sliced up little moments. But in another sense, I think, as well as timelessness, we can also draw on concepts of timefulness. And by time fullness, I mean recognizing that many cultures have, in a sense, been surrounded by cycles of time, cyclical forms of time. Again, indigenous cultures will often have this idea that, you know, time doesn't just go in one direction from the past through the present through the future, but it cycles round and round. And those cycles are linked, of course, to cosmological cycles of sun and moon and stars, the turn of the earth, the tides, all these kinds of things. And that our task, in a sense, one might say, is to recover that timefulness, to immerse ourselves in the wild clocks of the cosmos, which we've lost touch with, particularly in Western culture. So in a way, we need more time, but of a different kind, right? And that can This is also about helping us transcend that gap between ourselves and the living world to reconnect with cyclical forms of time that you might find in on the island of Bali or in Otomi Toltec culture in Mexico today, Mayan culture, where I've spent a lot of time doing research in Guatemala, those kinds of times. But on some sense, the cyclical forms of time are eternal. You know, they are about recognizing a kind of a balance and a harmony, you know, which of course is where ultimately we need to get to, because only in balance can we survive over the long term, both as a species, but as a on this one unique fragile planet.
Yeah, and also makes me thinking about the time frames that we also try to envision, you know, because there seems to be also a kind of you know, a kind of, how you say, awakening or struggling with, you know, there was a certain idea of a kind of possibility of an ecological social transformation that might happen, you know, in 10, 20, 30 years or something like that, and you know, people working towards that. But with what is happening today in many areas, seeing, oh, wait a moment, it's kind of going the other way in many ways, or there's a kind of backlash, you could say, or not really responding in an appropriate way to the crisis we are in. So maybe also a kind of need to widen the time frame in which we see also this kind of developments, or you know, how also for a culture to really change, that this is also a deep process that needs maybe more time.
Yeah, I think a lot of this is about expanding our time frames, our time horizons. I mean, I like to make a distinction between the marshmallow brain and the acorn brain that we have in our neuroanatomy. A marshmallow brain, which I mean, that's the part of our neuroanatomy which is all about short-term thinking, instant rewards, immediate gratification. I call it the marshmallow brain, named after a famous psychology test of the 1960s, where children had a marshmallow put in front of them. And if they could resist eating the marshmallow for 15 minutes, they were rewarded with a second marshmallow. And most kids couldn't resist and they ate the snack. But that's not the only part of our neuroanatomy. We also have what I think of as the acorn brain, which lives in our dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, front of the brain, which is all about long-term thinking and planning and strategizing. It's that wider view. And of course, I call it the acorn brain because, we put, almost every society, every culture has some kind of stories or spiritual traditions about planting a seed where the beneficiaries of the shade of the tree will be future generations. And I'm holding up here a little acorn, which I keep on my desk always. This acorn, in fact, is a very special one. It comes from the Buddhist monastery in southern France, Plum Village, and in fact, from just outside the hut where the great Vietnamese Zen monk Thich Nhat Hanh spent much of his life. And the acorn is from there. And for me, it's that ultimate symbol of that longer view. And that longer view is one which sort of is the opposite of how we, in a way, think of who we are. I mean, even in a political sense, if we think about who is a citizen, well, the citizens are also the unborn generations, who will be impacted by our actions. And in fact, never before in human history have our actions had such potentially damaging consequences for the generations to come. And one might say, well, that began on July the 16th, 1945, when the first nuclear test happened, the Trinity test, where we, in a way, from that moment on, we had the power to destroy the future. But of course, we've expanded that, not just by more nuclear weapons, but with, the impacts of the ecological crisis and technological risks. So I think there's a kind of paradoxical urgency. Right now, I think we really need to expand our time horizons, that longer view forwards and backwards, to develop, what I think of as kind of temporal intelligence, a kind of a wisdom to think and act across time, through time. I don't know. What do you think? Do we have any? Are you and actually, are you hopeful about the prospects for our civilization? I mean, you sound quite hopeful, but I'm not quite sure.
I think what I see resonates with what you are saying. I'm also quite devastated in a certain way by what is happening at the moment, but I feel hopeful in the sense that I have a deep trust in the sources of resilience of human beings and of our humanness, that there is also something inherently good and wise in our human nature. And I think also this crisis at the moment, I mean also things like AI or the destruction of the ecosphere, they really also point us to that depth in a certain way. Who are we really as human beings? I mean, when, for instance, if AI can do so many things and it has an intelligence that is, much faster, bigger than us in so many areas, what is it that we are as human beings then, really? And also, in seeing, the ecological destruction, I think it really points the finger to us in a very powerful way, to this question, who are we really? And I think there also that what you were saying with this temporal intelligence makes a lot of sense. And also I feel it points to a change in our identity also, how we see ourselves, how we see ourselves, that we are not this kind of isolated, subjects running around and trying to, make a good life. But that we are really part of a bigger happening as humanity, and that we can widen our awareness in that way to see, oh, we come from a history, from a human, unfolding evolution in whatever way that has many different facets and many cultures involved, and we also, move to a future that that we now are also seeding with what we are doing. And I think widening that sense of who we are in the sense of this interbeing, what you also pointed to, I think there is a sense that this is starting to happen in different ways. And there's also, I think, responses in human consciousness to that, to the need of this transformation. And in this way, I'm hopeful that there are this, how you say, this forces in our human nature and our human consciousness that move towards that widening of who we are. And that, I think, is a way of responding to what, the crisis we are in. And I think many of the examples you bring are also about that, of widening the sense of who we are and how we can be together.
Yeah, absolutely. It actually sort of makes me think of the metaphor of a whirlpool, in a river going round and round, and in the sense that we think of ourselves as individuals. We tend to think of ourselves as individuals, and we can look at a whirlpool in a river and say and point to it and say that's a whirlpool. But if you look closely, of course, the whirlpool has no edge. Where does it begin? Where does it end? And it's made of the water that comes into it. And there's the water that leaves it, and then it's the rocks around it and the wind around it and so on. And the whirlpool is just a flow, And I think if I look at my own books over the last decade, they're kind of like a societal, trying to give us a societal understanding of the whirlpool that, our whole societies collectively, we are part of this sort of a moving river. Of histories and cultures, things coming in, comes going out, and influences. Nothing is isolated. Everything is part of us. We have to think about what we're going to pass on down the river, of course. But ultimately, it is about a kind of a deep kind of interbeing that will widen our consciousness. But of course, our institutions are still, of course, organized around individualism. My children up the street from where I'm speaking now, they're, sitting in classrooms in rows on individual desks, going to do exams where they answer the questions themselves and not collaboratively in a group. Yet for the rest of their lives, they'll probably be engaged in having to collaborate with other people, So you look at our schools and think, this is mad, right? Yet it seems normal. So there's so much work to do in all realms. And I really believe in the power of what I think of as kind of applied history, that it's almost like a kind of subject that could be taught in schools and colleges and universities, that idea of learning from the past, finding hope, not just the bad stuff, but the good stuff, surprising ourselves by what we learn from different cultures and different epochs, and getting out of the, in a sense, getting out of the present moment, the present moment that Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg want us to be in, which is the present moment of scrolling on our phones, let's widen our horizons a little bit.
Yeah, that's interesting. When you're talking about the present moment, there's also, I find that it's quite interesting how there is a way the present moment can be a source of freeing ourselves from that kind of, needing to respond all the time. And it can be, like you said, there is a way to using our awareness to be, kind of caught in this present moment, and then the awareness is not really there to widen in the way
Yeah, I mean, in a
you
sense,
think
that
about it.
one could think about many of our cultural struggles being around attention, and who is dominating the present moment in a sense? Who is dominating our attention, and what can we do about that? What would it mean to have a revolution of attention? I think that's a sort of a potential lens through interpreting our times, I'd say, and seeing, as you say, that there's these different ways of thinking about the present moment, that we need to be aware of.
Yeah, and also what you're saying reminds me to that you said about this timefulness I mean, there's this mindfulness, but there's also timefulness, which I feel also there is a fullness of what we said about also what you brought in with this whirlpool image. It's also, a lot of the need for change or transformation is also set as kind of somehow we need to respond to the crises and which is true, but there's also a fullness that we can tap into in terms of seeing us as part of a much bigger horizon of time and of unfolding, like the kind of depth of consciousness and wisdom we can inherit from ancestors and from what came before us, and the kind of also joy to be able to give something on to future generations. It's not just a kind of obligation, but it's also a certain way it really lights our life up when it's not just for us in a way. And I think that's also something that you're pointing to, that to see, oh, my life is actually for something bigger in terms of not only the world, but also of time. It also makes it somehow frees us also in a way and brings us into a deeper responding to where life is and what we can be in our lives.
Yeah, that's beautifully said. And I think in a way, true mindfulness is also timefulness. It integrates a sense of continuity through time, or maybe transcendence of time in a sense. But I think in a practical way, something that's very important is that idea of the way it can help us think about our legacies. What do we want to pass on to the next generation? What is our gift in a way? We often talk about the idea of the golden rule, do unto others as you'd have them do unto you. But why not do unto future generations as you would wish past generations had done to you? Let's pass on a world better than the one that we found. And so this then brings us to the topic of death, of course, because most human beings, by the time they reach middle age, start thinking about what am I going to leave when I'm gone? Now, there's a way of thinking about our legacies which is very narrow, thinking about like being a Russian oligarch who wants to have a football stadium named after them when they're dead, which is a bit like the kind of Alexander the Great idea that he wanted a monuments of himself all across his empire. He saw himself as a living god. But what I think really matters is a wider sense of the legacies that we leave, which is like the gifts we leave to the universal strangers of the future and the world that they live in. To recognize that, as I wrote about in my book, The Good Ancestor, if I care about my daughter's life, who she could be alive in the year 2100, if I care about her life, I need to care about all life because she's not alone, right? She's part of a web of communities, she's part of the web of the living world, the water she drinks, the air she breathes. So I think when you start thinking seriously about timefulness in that sense of what happens when this body disappears, this body that I'm currently in goes, it invites us to be gift givers, let's say, to be gift givers. And that's a great challenge because we often look at the world that we're in and think, how can I control the gifts that are, or what's given to the next generation? Maybe I can create a nice piece of art, write a great poem or a book in my case, but then what about Wall Street, which will continue after I'm gone?
Yeah, it's really pointing to a whole, to a whole view of legacy for, you could say, the whole of life, which is always, life is always interconnected in that way as a whole.
Yeah, and I think we're also at a moment of history where collectivities matter. That we have inherited from the 20th century a hyper individualism from Sigmund Freud, from Oprah Winfrey, from the self-help industry. And sometimes that gets captured and hijacked. Even there are certain forms of kind of corporate mindfulness, which is all about Okay, how can we make our workers more calmer and less anxious so that they can work harder and make us more money? You know, I remember once talking to the great French Buddhist monk Mathieu Ricard, and he said, "Well, you could even have a mindful sniper who is so, focused on the present moment. All they're thinking about is, I'm going to very calmly kill that person in front of me." And we need to move ourselves from that individualistic culture into a more one based on collective values, I think. I can't see how we can navigate our way through the turbulence of the 21st century without a bigger sense of we than the sense of me. You know, I mean, it's so kind of obvious to say that, but you know, there's a great British filmmaker called Adam Curtis, who created a brilliant documentary, which anybody can probably find on YouTube, called The Century of the Self, which talks about the way the individual became the center of politics and culture in the 20th century. And it, in a way, is asking us to say, okay, what aspects of my life have I inherited from that culture? Because I probably have. Are there any of them that I can let go of? And in a way, what can I do with other people? I remember once hearing the great American environmental campaigner Bill McKibben being interviewed, and someone said to him, "You know, Bill, what should I do as an individual, you know, to change the world?" And he said, "Well, the first thing you can do is be less of an individual." And I thought that was a great answer. He said, "Do something with other people. It doesn't matter what it is." And in a way, that circles us back to the topic of Asabiya, because I think ultimately, you know, as I kind of said before, not everybody needs to be a radical protester or a politician or a religious leader or whatever it is. But if we can orientate ourselves to doing things with other people, whether it's working with other parents from your local school to put solar panels on the roof, or helping to run a local street market, it doesn't matter what it is on some fundamental level, because the task, let's say the existential task, is the opposite of what Jean-Paul Sartre said, which was kind of, what choices should I make? It's really about what choices should we make together. Yeah, I think that's where we are. The more choices we can make together, the greater chance we have of bending, not breaking, as a civilization.
Yeah, and that really points also to a certain, deep value and source of hope that there is something in human beings that we can do that we can actually do
Yeah, absolutely. This is
that.
one thing we're really good at, is actually cooperating together. You know, you only have to pick up a book, for example, like the great book Mutual Aid by the anarchist prince, the Russian anarchist prince Peter Kropotkin, that he wrote in 1902, which was a kind of a challenge to the Darwinian idea of survival of the fittest. It was about, we're a cooperative species. You know, so are lots of other species too, bees and ants and chimpanzees and so on. And we need to rediscover our cooperative selves in our social, political, economic organizations. But in a sense, on a deeper level, it comes from that sense of being a whirlpool, you know, being able to feel some kind of transcendence in a sense, and to know that my well-being is our well-being, and that the trees outside my garden are providing the oxygen that I breathe, and so those are my external lungs. So let's go together in this struggle.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Roman, for that beautiful conversation.
Well, it's been a real pleasure and privilege. I really enjoyed it. It has got my brain suitably buzzing. And you know, I used to work for many years with a historian called Theodore Zeldin, who used to say that a satisfying conversation is one that makes you say what you have never said before. And I said things I hadn't said before, so thank you for that.
Great. Thank you very much. Bye bye.